When we talked about what we might do this afternoon, we did give this, this morning, we did give this a title in case you wanted to pursue the question of women in ministry. We relate to that question in three different areas of seminary life, and we can talk about that if you'd like. It may be that out of the discussions we have had with you in the last 2 days, 2.5 days, other questions have developed that you may want to develop a little fuller, in a fuller way. If you want to do that, if you have any particular questions about what we've talked about earlier, we may want to do that, and if not, move on to this particular topic. Is that all right with you? Is that okay? Do you have other questions that grew out of the discussions or other issues we didn't get to explore in more detail?
We talked several times from a couple of perspectives about the problem that Southern Baptists are encountering with ordination. How do you study ordination? I've been part of several churches where the entire congregation lays on hands. Others where only the ordained persons do. Others where only the ordained men do. Ordination councils where the association had a standing ordination committee and a church dared not ordain somebody without that. Other churches, more so now, where there's nobody outside the church invited in for even an ordination council. It's totally an in-house thing, where deacons are ordaining the pastor, not fellow pastors. I think that the tradition is shot to pieces. And yet, you know, the Sunday school board very carefully waded into the matter of deacons and moved from business managers to the family ministry plan. How, short of that, can we reestablish ordination? I go back to the historical perspective where the association was the one who put the boundaries around doctrinal integrity or purity, whatever you want to call it. And now that's not even a function in most places. They don't even call the director of missions or ask for ordination by hands of peers. It's a pretty serious matter. We used to not ordain unless it was for at the request of a specific church.
Yes.
Now they're ordained for their sent to college, right along with the licensing. I'm sure Uncle Sam's tax laws have forced us to do some things, but it would seem that thing needs addressing from several standpoints and something to get it where we're almost forced to have to deal with.
You want us just to jump in at different points? I'll do it.
Well, it's
quick
come around
history
in several
view.
Different discussions, okay. The women thing, the fundamentalist thing.
A quick historical overview. I would recommend two editions of the Review and Expositor. And for the life of me, I can't give you the dates of the first one. There is an edition which came out between 1985 and the present. So somewhere in the last 2-3 years on ordination in Baptist life, that addresses this in a number of articles and sub-issues. I would recommend that highly. I would also have give you some attention to this new edition of the Review and Expositor, this most recent edition of the Review and Expositor called The Baptist Heritage, which addresses that broader issue. If you're going to study it as an association or a church. Ordination has had a mixed, and the way you get there, mixed history in Baptist life because we were sometimes congregational and we were sometimes what they used to call presbygational. When the association had a broader role in it, that really was a more presbygational perspective that related to some of the New England Puritans and their way of having the regional groups of churches monitor persons for ministry. And that would be a little more of a connectional system so that ministers might not just be ordained for and by one local congregation, but for and by, or at least with, the broader associational. That was before there was such a pluralism of churches. So the associational monitoring could have some kick to it. When you have so many churches developing and so many associations, you got into problems. There seems to be some historical evidence that early Baptist churches, the ordination was seen as the congregation's verification of the individualistic call. that with time, the individualistic call gained precedent over the congregational verification. So that really, you, if you said you were called, congregations seemed hesitant to suggest otherwise. And that's what you're talking about. This, I've been to high school ordinations. I call that infant ordination instead of infant baptism. We ruled out infant baptism, we had infant ordination. Because somebody got called at youth camp, you know. If all the preachers had been called at youth camp and surrendered and ordained, had actually gone into the ministry, we would have converted the world years ago. It's a blight on us. What is happening now, several things. The licensing was a way of, it was sort of monitoring the high school kids. You could license a high school kid or a college kid or a seminary kid and monitor them, and then you move to ordination after you had seen that they were indeed exercising gifts of ministry. But it's been varied. Some were local churches, some were associational, and so our congregational system made it hard to manage. What is happening around here is that local churches are finally developing guidelines for ordination. Crescent Hill was one of the churches in this area that first did it and has some excellent guidelines, and others have taken cues from that. And that is, it goes through the deacons. This is for ministry now, for a Christian ministry, not deacon ordination. It goes through the deacons. The deacons have a subcommittee who receive from the candidate a collection of documents that would include statement of call, conversion call, spiritual pilgrimage, doctrinal statement, and sometimes a doctrinal sermon, or at least a broader doctrinal statement that would combine those other two, personal pilgrimage and doctrinal ID. That is then read by a subcommittee of the deacons who interview the candidate, then bring a recommendation to the deacons as to whether or not to ordain that candidate on the basis of these documents. The deacons then bring the matter to the church, which votes. And Crescent Hill did it because we had so many people. And with that is, you must have some kind of request from a ministry situation. Now that can be, that's not hard and fast. We particularly find that difficult with women, because often women don't have that direct. They do if it's been chaplaincy. So often in cases where there is the sense of call and proven ministry to help, because sometimes it's a catch-22. You can't get a job if you aren't ordained, but you can't be ordained if you don't have a job. So often, particularly in the case of women, there have been some exceptions made. But those formal guidelines, I rather like that. And at the ordination council then, there will be representatives of the deacon council and then persons who are invited from the association, from the seminary, ordained persons who participate in the council.
Do you ever rescind an ordination?
Yes, we have had, in that process, I have been on some committees where we talked with the person and chose not to pursue ordination.
I mean, after they've been out in
ordination. Oh, you mean take it back? No, I have known of churches that are increasingly concerned about that, and I have heard of some that have done that. We have not had any of those kinds of occasions that developed in this community where I've been for 13 years.
But Pat Robinson laid his down. Everybody want to know to whom did he give it.
Yeah. See, and in our Presbyterian Congregational system, we don't know what to do about that. And again, that's either going to make us, it's tended to make us more individualistic and rely on the local church. In some cases, though, it's made us more connectional. The American Baptists are much more connectional in the way they deal with ordination. The whole question of preparation, we're about the only mainline denomination that doesn't have some requirements about training before ordination is given. The Presbyterians, the American Baptists, and all require seminary or equivalent in some shape or form and have an actual ordination procedure that people work toward.
We dealt with, you know, your general tradition, your landmark tradition, etc. And I wondered if you had traced it down like that.
Yes, and it would
trace some of it back.
Yeah.
To where that association got its early constitutional bylaw.
Apparently the English, with the associational ordinations, we apparently followed more of the English pattern, because in those fledgling Baptist churches in England, many of them developed, and I always forget which one, the particular or the general. I think it was the general that developed stronger associational ties. And so the association played a greater part in that ordination.
Well, it comes out, I guess the reason I'm pursuing the whole thing, the biggest issue with women in ministry seems to be over ordination.
It is.
They can do most anything, even in rank and file churches, until the thing of ordination. Mm-hmm. Now, does ordination come up primarily because of tax laws? Mm-hmm. Or do they come up...
For women or for everybody?
Well, period. I know we went into it with music directors, youth directors, yeah. and all yeah. that, primarily for housing.
Well, it's developed, it's gotten more complicated because of what ordination means in the culture and in the society. It also, it's been multifaceted, and I'll let them talk about this, but sometime the undercurrent was tax. It also was a way of affirming ministers who did ministry, valid Christian ministry, outside the pulpit. And then, we've all said probably, the study of ordination in regards to women revealed to us how we were taking our cues from ordination from a lot of different historical sources with minimal biblical guidance. Oh. You all talk about that. I don't want to talk to you.
Follow-up question along the same line. I'll make a statement and then I'll ask the question. The, quote, seminaries, unquote, are perceived as, number one, trying to eliminate the distinction between clergy and laity. And at the same time, they are perceived as pushing women ordination. Now, my question is that perception correct? Secondly, is there a tension between trying to eliminate the difference between clergy and laity, and at the same time pushing for women's ordination? That's my question.
I hadn't really thought about the perception of the seminaries as trying to do away with the distinction between clergy and laity. If anything, from my perspective in the middle of this, since we end up, I'm director of admissions, and one issue that comes into the admissions process is this person capable of being a, quote, professional minister? Can this person go into a church and lead that church in a professional way? So I guess my thinking is a bit warped by my role here in the community. I think there are two different agendas. One is the biblical foundation for ordination, which, as I understand it, is just not all that strong. We've gotten into ordination for reasons really other than the fact that the Bible commands us to do it. I know that you can bring some scripture in, but it's nowhere near as strong as it is for other things that we do. The second issue, though, is if we're going to ordain anybody, let's be equitable about it. The tradition in this century, as we've gotten more churches with staffs, people who feel called to ministry, but not to a preaching ministry. They feel, well, I'm called to a music ministry or a youth ministry or educational, so forth and so on. The feeling is, well, here I am a minister. And if the community doesn't accept me as a minister and doesn't recognize me, go back to what we said about symbols. There's a lot of power for us in the symbol of ordination. Maybe not for the congregation so much. They're, oh yeah, sure, we're having an ordination service tonight. But for the person who's committing his or her life to that, the community coming around and gathering around that person and affirming that person. Yes, we recognize your call. We respect it, and we respect you in that role. It's a very important thing. And the idea of doing it for some people, the idea of doing it for the chief executive officers and not for middle management, if you want to put it that way, is a bit repulsive to those in middle management. So I think those are the two different agendas going on. If we want to get biblical about it, I'm not sure we really ought to ordain anybody. But if we're going to get into that for whatever reasons,
That's right.
But if we're going to do it at all, let's do it across the board equitably so that we don't exalt one sort of ministry over another.
I think the interpretation, too, of the priesthood of believers, individual believer, is one that from the black church perspective, that I hear the black church affirming more positively the fact that everybody is called of God. And what does that mean? And that's what it really breaks down. But I hear that being taught and preached quite consistently. You all are called of God. Now, that in the black church, the issue of ordination is not where it is in Southern Baptist life. is really not an issue. Yet, it will be an issue. Mm. There are black women who are being ordained, but everybody's ignoring it. I mean, you know, the convention president just says he's neutral. How can you be neutral? Okay, and so no one wants to talk about it, but everybody's preaching and teaching. Not everybody, many are preaching and teaching. Preach to the beliefs, the oneness in Christ. Everybody is a priest. Everybody has a call on their life, and you want to affirm that call and seek your gifts. Every person has been gifted for ministry, but then it breaks off. Some people are gifted for professional ministry, and then it's hard to define.
The black church, which I'm familiar with, for instance, would not and does not permit laity even on the podium.
It depends on where you are.
Yeah. And so there is a real distinction between laity and clergy with the black church in that area. And as you stated previously, of course, the black churches here, I think, are more landmark maybe than there are other places. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, especially in Kentucky.
Yeah. But ours are very landmark. And I think the black churches in our area would be much slower about recognizing women in the ministry than the white churches.
One of the mixed bags is the black community has always affirmed women in other denominations in ministry. Okay, and mm-hmm. and they have been allowed to come and speak on the floor. yeah, we talked about fellowshipping earlier. They were not here. But the Methodist church would be allowed to come to the Baptist church with a woman pastor, and she would be given an opportunity to speak, but from the floor. Now, I grew up in Virginia, and that's completely different in Virginia. Where I grew up in Virginia, children, women, everyone had an opportunity always to speak from the pulpit. But I came to Kentucky, and our deacons won't walk into the pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
I had to tell the custodian he could go up there and dust. I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm serious about that. It's okay
dance.
To go up there and dust.
Mm-hmm. The Baptists were never Quakers nor Anglicans. They never had a total laity, a church of the laity, or a church of the clergy. And they did live with this tension, you're quite correct. And the pendulum swings back and forth. The seminaries, I thought you were going to say the seminaries keep pushing the professionalization of the clergy more than the relationship between clergy and laity. But I see your point in that what the seminaries are doing is trying to train ministers who will go into churches and help the people we train, the people we train will help the people they train to be ministers.
Mm-hmm.
And to see that this is, you don't just hire a minister. When you want to do work with singles, you don't just hire a minister to singles. You may. But you hire somebody who motivates you to minister to singles. That's one where we are. Then we're not, I'd say we're not pushing the ordination of women. We're responding to what the church has started. Women aren't coming here because of Ms. Magazine, Tina Turner, and, what's her name? Jane Fonda. They're here because they grew up in churches where this is what they heard. When Jesus tells you to do something, you do it. When the Lord comes to you and guides your life, you commit yourself to Him and go wherever He takes you. And we didn't have a disclaimer clause. I say if we wanted women to avoid ordination, we should teach women to sing, little girls to sing, wherever He leads you go. Or I surrender some, you see. When you said surrender all, it was inevitable that the piety of our spirituality would lead women to say, all doors are open to us. God will call us to do this. My point with ordination theologically is not that you find it, the ordination of women or the participation of women, you don't find it in the New Testament. If you look for proof texts, you find a first century response to women. So I tell the women here, don't go to the New Testament and look for a proof text that will affirm you functioning as males have functioned. What you look for is what black people look for. You can't find that about slavery, about being free and not having slaves either. And until Paul came along, you couldn't find it about not being Jewish before you became Christian. There is a broader principle than even the first century references. And that is, in Christ, there's neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave or free. But this is the broader principle. There is therefore now no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus. So my theological response is, if you don't want women to be ordained, you should never baptize them. Because it is baptism that opens the door to all of the kingdom.
But you're taking a scriptural context and trying to apply it to a non-scriptural thing.
Why?
Because ordination isn't scriptural. You just said that, and I agree with that.
But you see, okay, now I'm working as a pragmatist. It doesn't matter that ordination is not scriptural. There are a lot of things that aren't scriptural. Baptizing 9-year-olds isn't scriptural, but we do it, you see. So what you have proto-ordination in the New Testament. They didn't have time to develop a way of affirming those who carried out the gifts. They set them aside and laid hands on them to go do certain things, and they have, as early as 2 Corinthians, they have this conflict, same conflict we have, between the settled apostolic person, St. Paul, and the traveling charismatics. He calls them super apostles in 2 Corinthians. You have the tension between the traveling charismatic and the settled pastor. You begin to see that already. What happens is you have the evolution of a tradition that has proto-biblical guidance, but no specific biblical reference that will carry it out. And so since you have it, you can either convince Southern Baptists to stop ordaining everybody. And I'd be willing to work for that. If we want to sign a pact and we'll all do it, we'll come back here in a year and see how far you get. Or you then bring to bear what I would see as the broader biblical guideline on how you deal with whatever you may do that may or may not specifically be in Scripture. Ordination, for example. Slavery also, you see. The same hermeneutic that was used by our forebearers in 1845 about slavery is a similar hermeneutic to the woman's. And that hermeneutic does have biblical precedent because it's the same hermeneutic Paul used to deal with the Judaizers in Galatians. And so you do have biblical guidance for that. That's why I don't want to go looking for proof texts about ordination or baptism, ordination or slavery. I want to look for the biblical guidelines that answers the question, whatever the historical circumstance. That's why you start with baptism.
Back down the line somewhere, though, when the Internal Revenue said that licensed, ordained, or whatever,
affirmed, commissioned,
Baptists made a choice to skip over licensing.
Yeah.
To authorize. Now, somebody made that choice for us. I doubt it ever came as a resolution.
Habit, yeah.
But it would seem like that a practical approach to this would be denominational authority, if we have any, giving a ruling that IRS will buy that says that a person who is licensed is qualified to do whatever needs to be done in the name of ministry. And remove that, because it is not fair for a minister of music who makes far less of a salary, anyhow, not to be able to take housing allowance when he's devoting full time to music.
When I was in college as minister of youth at a church in South Louisiana, the local laws were such that I had been licensed at the time. I had fought off ordination, as a matter of fact, because I just didn't want to do that yet. And I went down to the parish courthouse, in Louisiana's a parish, not a county, and signed the register. And there were several things I could do. I don't remember now, to tell you the truth, if I could do a wedding, but I think that I could, just as
yes,
a licensed wedding.
In some places, minister. In Kentucky, you could.
That varies.
Wouldn't want you to do a baptism or officiate the Lord's Supper. We've had a hard time.
I did not, but I could have there. My experience is so different.
Says that you don't unless you're ordained.
I got a call yesterday from a pastor in Indiana who had just come to a church, and the previous pastor had not been ordained, and the deacons were saying to two of the women in the church, you don't have a valid baptism because our pastor was not ordained. You got to go do it again. Just
so
yesterday.
Somehow our denominational hierarchy could address some of these. Maybe we need a new polity manual. We haven't had one in a long time. Maybe somebody needs to address them up. That ought to bring a lot of things to the line.
Well, you still have another situation there. The authority of the local church, right, who can designate any deacon or anyone else to do that.
To do whatever.
Sure.
We talk about, though, the authority of the local church, and we preach about it and don't practice it. The government will tell us what we're going to do and what we're not going to do, and the big thing of ordination that I remember when I was in Central Kentucky hit the wheel because a woman was going to be a chaplain for the Veterans Administration, and the only way Southern Baptists recognized her was ordination. And I thought, of course, not believing in ordination at all, it was a crock of stuff to me, but I thought, you know, it's wrong to go on and do something that the majority of folks don't believe in and try to judge. That's why I said, you know, what that's what I was getting at, the thing of, she needed recognition. It had to do with her livelihood. She counseled people that I couldn't counsel as a chaplain. And I agree, we need something to do with polity. We say one thing, but we allow another thing to happen on local church, and I believe in the local ecclesia. We need to address it. Well, we might need to set up something in this year to address it. I wish some president or guy running would have the guts to address the affirmation of let's do something to affirm people who feel called to do certain things. I wouldn't want to do certain things some women feel called to do, but they're skilled in doing that. And if they're going to work for the government, they've got to have this certification. Mm-hmm. They've got to have something. I just resent the word. I just resent ordination.
Yesterday, some of us were talking about the seminary in a couple of contexts. One had to do with women enrollment. Another had to do with divorced persons. And those are two very separate issues. Sometimes I've heard people run those together, and they're very, very distinct. I got a few facts and figures. This might be as good a place as any to drop them in. Two academic years ago, for the first time in our history here at Southern, there were more women in the School of Theology than there were women in any other of the other schools. More women in theology than in music, social work, or Christian education. Now, the proportion is the opposite. The proportion in the School of Theology is the lowest of all the schools. Just because the School of Theology is so big, there are so many men there, that the proportion of women is the lowest in that school, but the number is the highest. Churches are sending us women to be trained with full knowledge. This is where they're headed. They recommend them. Nobody gets into this seminary, or ever has. Our charter since 1859 has required that the local church approve someone to the seminary. We have a form that the church fills out. They vote to say that this person is qualified for ministry. Again, my role here warps me a little bit, my perception perhaps, but I can't help but think that if there are enough churches out there, and it's not just a handful of churches sending us all these women, you know, they're from all over. If they're sending them to us, eventually they're going to come around to a point where things will begin broadening and changing. The same thing with divorced people. I would not have said this 2 days ago before I got to know you, but I'll say it now. We had a conference here, a workshop for students here who've been divorced. We couldn't advertise it because we didn't really want to endanger the rights and privileges of the divorced students we do have. We had 45 students attend the workshop, and that's by no means all we have. Our proportion is the same or lower as other seminaries, so we don't have an unusual proportion. Churches are sending us people, either divorced and single or divorced and remarried, who are called, who say they're called to ministry. Their experience is such. Remember what we talked about yesterday between the pull between experience and the traditional theology. Their experience is such that they've been called, and the churches are affirming that. Now, I know there are churches who just vote to send the guy on and don't give it a whole lot of thought.
They don't know what to do with it back there, and we'll just send him to the seminary. That's what happens a lot of
times. That does happen a lot of times. But there are so many, I can't believe it happens in all of them.
And thank God we straighten them all out, don't we?
That's right.
There are never any problems after that.
You're the
Pope. That's right.
Ray, you got a perfect
testimony. I want to ask you something. I believe it was you that mentioned something about rebaptisms and you're switching gears a little bit from what we've been talking about. But I read recently where the trend, the number of baptisms were getting, I mean, people being baptized were younger and younger, down as low as 4 and 5 years old.
It usually runs about 2,000 to 3,000 preschoolers in the SBC a year. Isn't that about right?
Okay, my question is, do you see any connection with this trend and the trend of rebaptism?
Oh, yeah.
In other words, of a child, a preschool child, who is just, you know, joins church and baptized, later on possibly realized, I didn't even understand what anything was.
Again, for me, The bottom is the standard by which we judge the nature of the church and the nature of conversion and the nature of baptism. And that was a numerical standard. So people who are under pressure are apt to rebaptize people to get that count and then baptize people younger to get that count at the same time. And then often, these are you may know this, but these are people who come through a church and do those two things and then they leave and you've got a bunch of baptized preschoolers and a bunch of rebaptized adults.
So what you're saying is pressure on both ends.
On both ends.
Causing these two.
And then it feeds the cycle. And that is what happens when the 4 and 5 year olds are not nurtured in any sense of the word. And you pretty much have the same principle as infant baptism when you do 4 and 5 year olds. You're getting so close to that in terms of cognitive, aren't you? But then they are ready candidates for rebaptism, certainly in their teens and possibly later on, because they've created that cycle. And it's interesting to me, often the same people who will work adults up because they were not given the plan of salvation appropriately as children are the same people who will baptize another group of children. So it's a cycle.
And this is fed by the full-time evangelist who has to get results. If he doesn't get results, he won't be called again.
Yes, and that's been documented in American religion since Charles G. Finney. So it's not just, we can't just blame this contemporary crowd. That's a long and
we're still a professional pastor, but we also see with some pastors.
Well, often the pastors take their cues from this same mentality. One of the studies I would love to do, and I guess you can't do it because most of the stuff is not written down, I would like to see how the role of the professional evangelist in the 20th century in Southern Baptist life, for example, influenced the development of popular theology. For example, do any of you know the name T.T. Martin, who was a fiery old evangelist in Tennessee and showed up at the Scopes Monkey Trial and preached in a tent when William James Bryan and Clarence Darrow were in Tennessee? Dale Moody used to tell me that he believed T.T. Martin was one of the people responsible for making once saved, always saved the watchword in Southern Baptist life about perseverance of the saints. And I never documented that, but it would be interesting to see how premillennialism, once saved, always saved, a theology of conversion, mass evangelism, the popularizing of what would be the basic doctrines in the Baptist faith and message, or the popularizing of certain ideas in various handbooks on how you do a church, was done by the evangelists. And I think we would find a very close correlation.
I'd like to see somebody deal with church role a little bit. If there was no such thing as a church letter, church role, and membership was simply on the basis of active participation, we could eliminate a lot of these.
Millions.
We have a radical in the back row.
Yeah, millions then, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Anybody ever address that? Even discuss church role, Christ membership kind of thing?
I don't know. That would be an interesting thing for particularly people in our Christian education school to pursue, but I don't know it.
We have a number of covenant type churches, though.
Mm-hmm.
They're popular.
Mm-hmm.
A concern I have is young seminarians, as they finish their education here and as they come to the association, maybe not having a place to go, looking for some assistance at that particular time. We're finding the demand more and more from those persons when there are not that many churches out there. We have 102 churches, and there's not as much turnover as there once was.
That's going to be my question.
Yeah. You're seeing this.
Yeah.
Peter Drucker says, if I was looking for a person to be a small businessman, I'd look for a man who's been with a company, a large company, 5 or 7 years, because he learned how to organize, he learned how to work with people. He said, then that person would be a good person then to start a new business. Is there any effort being made on helping these young seminarians to go into any associate role anywhere that would maybe for a year, I think like we have a number of churches that could support that kind of ministry of getting this person maybe a year, and then for them to go from that associate role into a church. Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be much better equipped.
I agree.
My point of that is, you had a person here.
The teenage pregnancy thing, I've been saying that for years about the problem, and pastors say, no, that isn't a problem until a pastor's daughter gets pregnant, mm-hmm. and there's only one way to get pregnant, and it wouldn't happen, but it did. And it talks about abstinence, mm-hmm. not just from sex, but from alcohol and drugs, and helps deal with this. That's another place where we can have a responsibility. It may be unpopular.
I would say there's a chance that the church's response will be different to AIDS than it has been to teen pregnancy, and not necessarily in a good way different. By 1991, when AIDS has added 10% to the death rate in this country, if the medium or higher scenarios actually take place, people are more and more quickly, as past infections become overt and the disease really hits, people will know people in their churches or at work who have the disease and who die from it. That could make us react very strongly to it, perhaps not in a healthy fashion. That's something I said yesterday or the day before. I'll repeat here what we've just done. Now is the time to begin emphasizing theologies of ministry to the suffering, instead of allowing the sociological trends toward isolation of various groups to continue. We need to start battling that now, not just on AIDS, but that is going to be a place where it's most visible.
I think that'll be the final word, at least for this hour of formal discussion.
Finally, I had the last word.
I hope you'll feel free to carry this on in a formal way. I'd like to ask you if you would take this moment to turn in your folders to